matter what people say, we got it going on. Who cares about what they think?
You know me, I'm the hottest in this
scene. WJMS, this is According to RP.
Turn up the volume, kick back, and get raw with us.
From the latest hip-hop beats,
spazzle,
to social issues that cripple the black community, all from the perspective of a young, strong black woman.
A strong black woman.
Welcome back, everyone, for another episode of According to RP on WJMS Radio. It's your girl, Rita Pierre, your host. And as always, I hope you guys are striving, thriving, and surviving in these corona-infested streets. So I just wanted to, one, say happy Sunday, and two, say happy new week, and three, I want to thank you all for tuning into another episode of According to RP. And I want to thank you all, especially for last week. You guys tuned in to the whole hour and 42 minutes of our show. And what I truly appreciated was the feedback that you gave. You guys gave so much positive feedback. I can probably write a book. Every day, literally, I got text messages, calls, emails, DMs about how much you guys learned from last week's episode. So I just want to thank you guys for being so dedicated to the According to RP platform. Thank you for being just part of the tribe. I also want to take this time to publicly thank our guest from last week, Ja Ace. I mean, your show was so inspirational. It was so motivational to so many people on so many different levels. And the fact that you were just able to be so open, honest, candid, transparent with us was just so necessary. I think in order for us to really move forward as a people, transparency is important. And you were so transparent with your story, with, you know, with just with your life. And, you know, to be on a national platform, and yes, I said national because people are tuning in across the country and in the UK, actually. But I digress. But to be on a platform like this and to share a piece of yourself with strangers, with people who you do not know, it takes a lot of guts and it takes a lot of courage. So thank you so much for just being that person for us last week. So this week, we have another amazing guest. I know I call them all amazing, but that's because they are. So this week's amazing guest goes by the name of Dominique DuPont. He's become a friend of mine. We've been doing some great work together for the community. And I mean, his story is definitely inspirational. Some of you guys might know him or might know his name from a documentary that was aired, I think it was a couple of years ago, Raised in the System. It was a production by Michael K. Williams. And so he is going to talk about Raised in the System, but he's also just going to talk about his life, really, about being a young teen locked up in prison, serving 20 years. But what I think is so inspirational about his story is what he made of the time, you know, that he spent in prison, being a leader, being a director of various programs, helping other inmates reach their potential, you know, see, find hope, believe in themselves, and to make the best of their time. I think, you know, with that story, it's just so powerful because oftentimes when we think about individuals who spend significant times in prison, we don't think much of them. We don't think that they can be a leader. We don't think that they can be anything. And I think that by him talking about his journey and by him sharing his story, I think and I hope that it starts to change the mindset of those in the community and it starts to change how we view our, you know, fellow brothers and sisters, how we view the youth, how we view people who make mistakes. We all make mistakes and a lot of us are one mistake from, you know, ruining our lives, if we're going to be honest. So I think that, you know, these men who are sharing their stories, who are being transparent, you know, it's really important that we pay attention to what they have to say. Dominique is doing so many great things in the community as well. I don't want to go into too much because I want you guys to keep it locked. I want you guys to tune in to the story. But like I said, very inspirational, very powerful. And, you know, I really hope that you guys stay tuned for his story. So now, before we get into the meat of the show, you guys know that it is time for our Urban Dictionary word or phrase of the week.
Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth?
May I have the definition?
What does skeet skeet mean?
What's on fleek?
Can you use it in a sentence?
I'm on fleek, lit.
And it's gonna be lit.
Major key.
It's time for the Urban Dictionary word or phrase of the week.
So this week's Urban Dictionary word or phrase of the week is cradar. Cradar, an organ in your mind that detects how cray other people are. Now, I have never heard anybody in my entire time on this earth use this word cradar. I've heard gaydar. I've heard, I don't know, other dars. I've never heard cradar. But it is an interesting word because you know what? It does. I can see how it can fit, right? Some of us have, I call it spidey senses. I think I have good spidey senses. I can sense when somebody's off their rockers, off their meds, when somebody is, I don't know, two crayons short of a crayon box. Cradar, I've never seen it before. I've never heard it, but I mean, I don't know. I don't know if it's a word that I'll be entering into my vocabulary, that I have cradar. I think I like spidey senses better. But, I mean, it makes sense. It's not the worst word we've heard on this show, right? We've had some very, very bad Urban Dictionary definitions. This one's not so bad. I don't love it, but I don't hate it either. But either way, cradar, an organ in your mind that detects how cray other people are. I mean, like I said, I don't love it, but I don't hate it either. So either way, that is the word of the week. So now moving on to my favorite section of the show, it is now time for the big up of the week. Watch it. You can big up, big up. So this week's big up of the week goes to a young teen from the community, from the Brooklyn community, Paris McKenzie. So many of you have already seen this story because you guys have been sharing it like wildfire, which I totally love and appreciate you all for doing. But 16-year-old Paris McKenzie is the youngest person to own a beauty supply shop in Brooklyn. She is an entrepreneur. She is a high school student, a junior at that, taking honors classes, and still somehow she finds ways to own and operate a beauty supply in Brooklyn. And so this shop opened about a month ago, and I believe it is called Paris Beauty Supplies with a Z. It's on Church Avenue in Brooklyn. So ladies and gentlemen, let's support our young sister. Let's support her. She's young. She could be doing anything. And we know what 16-year-olds are capable of doing and what they are currently doing in these streets. But this one right here is out here being a whole entrepreneur. And we also know that within our Black communities, it is the Asians and the Arabs, or the Arabs, sorry, that own and operate beauty supplies. So the fact that we are seeing, you know, these establishments that are frequented more so, if not 100% by Black people, are now being owned by Black people. So she definitely, definitely, definitely deserves a round of applause. But I just hope and pray that we as a community support her. She's going to need a lot of support. And I hope that you guys frequent her shop. I hope that you guys, you know, refer, let's repost her. I know that I am going to go and buy a couple of things from her shop. But again, it's very beautiful to see the young people taking control of their lives and contributing back to the community, because this beauty shop is a contribution to our community. So big up to you. Big up to you. So now, with every high, there is a low. And this week, I promise, we're not going to be talking about Bill de Blasio or NYPD, because they tend to be the womp-womps of the week very frequently on this show. But this time, we're back to the DOE. The DOE hasn't gotten so much flack from me, but the DOE is our womp-womp of this week, right? So a recent article has surfaced as of yesterday from the New York Post stating that the DOE keeping secrets of a full list of schools with COVID-infected teachers. Now, this is very troubling to me because school is about to start on September 21st, allegedly, right? And the teachers, though, they have gone back to school, I think, as of last week to kind of prepare for the students that will be coming in the next about week and a half. Since the reopening of these buildings, there have been 24 reports of teachers testing positive, right? And this is not just like in Manhattan or only in Brooklyn. This is throughout the boroughs. I think only Queens has not, reported an incident. But throughout all of the boroughs, altogether, 24, since reopening, 24 teachers have been in these buildings operating, moving around with COVID in their system. And the DOE has said nothing. So there were reports from other colleagues that have said that they didn't even know. Like DOE knew about this and did not share the wealth of information. They did not alert the other colleagues that Corona was walking in their midst. And I find that it's very problematic because parents, teachers, the community as a whole, we are very, very concerned about the reopening of schools. We are very concerned about the lack of information that we're receiving with regards to the coronavirus and how the DOE plans to really control this. It's like mum's the word. I've been on a couple of Zoom calls for my son's school and nobody knows anything. They didn't even know when school was going to start. Like nobody knows anything. And that's very problematic because we're talking about the coronavirus that is still killing people. People are still dying. It's not a myth. This is not like a fake disease. This is a virus that's out here literally killing people. And we've already received many reports from Dr. Fauci and friends that children, are carriers of this virus, and they can appear asymptomatic, but they can, then transfer this virus to abuela, abuelo, grandma, grandpa, mommy, daddy. Like, you know what I mean? So this is something that's very serious. This is not a game. And I feel like the DOE and city government thinks that it is a game. So, this is very troubling for me personally, because again, I do have a 13-year-old who I do plan to send to the building because I feel like educationally that's best for him. But I think I'm going to have to reevaluate that, because we have teachers rolling up to the schools, COVID positive, and the DOE is not really, they're not releasing information. They're not being transparent. And it's very problematic, because if they're not being transparent about that, what else are they keeping from us? So DOE, get your lives together. This is ridiculous. That's why you're the Womp Womp of the Week. All right, everyone. I'm here with my very special guest, Dominique DuPont. Dominique, say hello.
Hey, how's everybody doing? Thanks, Rita, for having me.
You're welcome. You're welcome. So it's funny, last week I had Ace on the show, and this week I have you. And we're going to be talking a little bit about the same things, but obviously two different people, two different lives, two different pathways. So I just want you to just introduce yourself. Let us know who you are, what you do, where you're from.
Cool. Thanks. So my name is Dominique DuPont, and who am I? Sometimes I think I'm still trying to figure that out. I served 21 years in prison, close to 21 years, 20 years, 7 months and 18 days in prison. That process started for me at a very young age. Some of my teens in prison, all of my 20s, all of my 30s. And started my 40s prior to receiving a commutation from Governor Cuomo. Those announcements were made on December 27th, 2017. I was the subject of a daily news article on December 28th, 2017, and then released just 3 weeks later, January 22nd, 2018. And so So that's a huge part of what my experience is about. It's, you know, being in prison, just thinking about would I ever make it out of prison, you know, receiving a life sentence at a really young age. So that's a huge part of my story. Outside of that, you know, I'm a husband, I'm a brother. I am someone who's committed to making a successful transition back into the community. And what that means to me is doing the work, identifying people who have skin in the game and are willing to be part of the solution and no longer part of the problem. So that's who I am. Some of the things that I've done since my reentry have been connected to a lot of the work that I was doing while I was in prison, helping men realize that if they can do the work on the inside, that they'll see the fruits on the outside. Mm-hmm. And what that meant for me and for most of the men that I dealt with while I was in prison was doing some serious introspection about who you are, how you got to where you are, and what are the possibilities of not just getting out, but staying out. And so what that meant was I was doing a lot of work, mentorship work in prison through a program called the Youth Assistant Program. Ace briefly talked about that when he was here last week. I also was the director of that program for 14 years. I also worked closely with men in prison through another program called the Alternatives to Incarceration Program, AVP, where we provided alternatives to situations that encompass conflict and found successful ways of communicating without things going south. And then I worked with people who were infected and affected by HIV and AIDS as a peer counselor in prison. I went to college while I was in prison. And just basically wanted to identify people with skin in the game and be true to who I am. So in a nutshell, that's who I am. Those are some of the things that I was doing. Ultimately, I got the attention of Governor Cuomo and worked closely with my uncle on a project that aired on HBO. And we received the Emmy nomination for called Raised in the System. And we've been doing amazing work on the outside as I run his non-for-profit called MKW. Most people think it stands for Michael K. Williams. It doesn't. It stands for Making Kids Win.
Okay.
He's most famously known for some of his roles in The Wire's Omar Little.
I loved The Wire. Yeah. And I actually loved his character. Because, you know, normally you'll find that one character where you're like, I cannot stand them. Mm-hmm. Like, what was the other one? Stanville? I forgot the other guy.
Stringer Bell?
Yes. Yeah. Couldn't stand him, but...
So he did that. He did Boardwalk Empire's Chalky White. And now he's doing a really new series that came out on HBO called Lovecraft Country. So, we really moved into this space primarily when he worked with Ava DuVernay on When They See Us. And so thankfully I was out. Was released shortly before Raising the System was released. And I also had an opportunity to be in the edit room for that project and then worked closely and managed him in my role as just running what he has going on. And I basically was able to do that. So it's been interesting. I've been on a lot of sets with him. Mm-hmm. I had a chance to meet Ava and a lot of other people doing this work, state, local, federal officials. A huge part of what we've done has been, you know, going into the prison system, screening Raised in the System, doing the work, meeting with people in law enforcement, state, local, federal officials, corrections, NYPD, and others. And also grassroots organizations, groups who work in a crisis management system to reduce gun violence and gang violence in the community. We've been on that front since COVID. We've been doing a lot of work in the community, giving out PPE equipment and just hitting hard communities like Brownsville and East New York to see if we can raise some awareness and help people in our community. So.
That's a lot.
It is.
But it's a lot of good stuff, you know, and it's, you know, it's interesting because, you know, you talked about being in on the inside for 20 years, right? Yeah. Now, I kind of want to know, how did you rise to the level of leadership? Because, you know, those of us who are on the outside, who mm-hmm. don't really know exactly what's going in, you know, we're trying to figure out, like, how does that transition work, right? Because we know that there are people when they're in the inside, they kind of like, you know what, I just want to do my time, keep my head down, whatever. Then there's the troublemakers who are just trying to start stuff up. Mm-hmm. But it's always interesting to see, like, how does one decide, I'm going to be a leader, I'm going to make the best out of the time that I have in this space?
Yeah. You know what, that's really important. For me, it was easy. I come from a really good family, good values. Got caught up in a situation where I bought a loaded firearm to an already lit situation, and that was unfortunate. I wanted to honor my victim, and I knew that that leadership was influence. It could either be positive influence or negative influence. I wanted to be able to do my time and not have my time do me. So that was key for me. I also, I realized that it was super important for me to make it out of prison. And I knew that that was going to take work. Mm-hmm. And before I knew what the word clemency or pardon or commutations meant, I knew that there were a bunch of people in this community that I was in, albeit it was a maximum security prison, they needed help and they were trying to figure themselves out and trying to figure out how they got here. I knew that there were good people in prison. I knew that prison is often identified as a bad place mm-hmm. that sometimes good people get caught up in and make bad decisions and bad choices. And so I took my time in prison, but I didn't waste my time.
Okay.
And that's how I rose to the rank of leadership in prison. It was me being willing to stand up for what was right, when it felt right, when I knew it was right, even though most times in prison was left as right, was right as wrong, was hot as cold, was cold as hot. I wasn't a person to succumb to that type of ideology. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't who I am. And thankfully someone recognized that and said, listen, you know, we want to see if you could help us accomplish this work in the community. So.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I'm listening to it. You know, I've watched a lot of documentaries over the last couple of years. There's been like this focus, right, on prison life. I'm a Netflix person, so I've watched a lot of these Netflix documentaries, just, you know, kind of seeing what life is like, right, on the inside, and just thinking, you know, for an individual to be in for that long, like, at any point did you think that, man, I'm gonna be in here forever? Like, there
plenty
really
of times.
Isn't no hope. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I realized that, you know, if you don't have hope, then most of the time you'll probably be hopeless. And that's a dark place to be. Mm-hmm. And I started with recognizing and appreciating the little things. You know, I had life. I had breath. And when you have those two things, you do have hope, even if it feels like you don't. Mm-hmm. And I had the opportunity to wake up every day. I had an opportunity to impact people's lives in a very positive way, right where I was at. Mm-hmm. And even though I would have probably preferred to be somewhere else, that wasn't my reality. Mm-hmm. And I had to know that. I had to own that in a way where most people wouldn't. And those were the things that helped me maintain my composure and realize that I could be an asset right where I was at. Mm-hmm. You know, accountability and responsibility is huge for me. You know, obviously there were mitigating circumstances that led me to prison. You know, I own that. But I also knew that, you know, I had to be held accountable and responsible for my bad actions. What I identify as bad choices. And I also realized that wasn't an excuse for me to continue to make bad choices. Mm-hmm. It was an opportunity for me to elevate myself and hopefully elevate people that surround me.
Now, what's interesting about both you and Ace is the fact that you both say, listen, I came from good families. You know, I came from a good background, absolutely, supportive family members, supportive, you know, I don't know if you said supportive friends, but supportive family members. And as I had stated last week, you know, when you think about individuals who go down certain paths, mm-hmm, you automatically think that this kid was either from the foster system, they came from a very, very bad neighborhood and their parents were never around, nobody cared about them, so that's why they took to, you know, the streets or the life of crime. Right. But I think it's amazing that you guys can share your story because it shows people that, you know, it is about choices, right?
Absolutely.
And a good kid, a quote-unquote, I guess, good kid can, in a sense, end up on the same path as somebody who's, quote-unquote, like a bad kid. It's really about choices.
I've seen both. I've seen bad kids that we thought would definitely be in prison, mm-hmm, be successful. And I've seen kids that we thought would never be in prison or have some run-in with law enforcement end up in prison with a life sentence. Mm-hmm. I mean, life is about choices.
Yeah.
And one bad choice, one failure to assess a situation, you know, that 5 seconds that it takes to determine whether you're going to do this or do that can literally turn your life upside down, mm-hmm, for the rest of your life. And so we can't waste time. We have to, you know, find effective ways to think about things before we make choices and we make decisions and know that it will affect us and the people who love us. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's important to hear these stories because it allows people to be sympathetic and empathetic, right? Not so quick to just, you know, cast people aside because of the end result. Because, I mean, even myself, I can probably look back at maybe several moments where I might have had that opportunity to make a decision that could have ruined my life. And I think that that's everybody's case. But some people, you know, either they didn't get caught or whatever the case is, right? And I think that as society, we kind of fail to really, you know, step back and realize that, you know, we could have easily been involved in a situation that could have took us out, right?
Absolutely.
So, you know, now that you're out, right, do you think that, because I know when I was talking to Ace, he was talking about how these were the cards that he was dealt, mm-hmm, and that things had to happen this way in his life, right? Mm-hmm. Looking back at the work that you did in the prisons, the lives that you changed, right? Do you feel like, I guess, how Ace kind of characterized that these were the cards that you were dealt and that, I guess, life had to have happened this particular way for you maybe to reach those men, you know, and I guess impact them in the way that you did?
You know, that's a really good question. You know, I believe in destiny. I believe in God, you know, and I believe what will be will ultimately, mm-hmm, will be. And I may not know like how that's going to unfold, but I'm sure God does. And I think the reality is that how things, you know, ultimately turn out is, you know, the analogy that you talked about with the cards, mm-hmm, right? Like, so, you know, I get a set of cards. You know, I learned this in prison because guys play cards a lot.
Do they play spades a lot?
They do, yeah. But one of the, I'll use that analogy because I think it's really a great analogy, right? So you're playing spades, you know, you're given a hand from a deck, and you got to figure it out, mm-hmm, right? And sometimes in life, oftentimes in life, we're in the process of trying to figure things out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something's going to happen tomorrow and you're going to have to figure it out. And something's going to happen next week and next month. And guess what? You don't know that whatever's going to happen next week or next month or next year is going to happen. You, mm-hmm, don't know that. Nobody knew COVID was going to happen,
yeah,
right? We all got dealt, you know, and we had to figure some things out. Some things we had control over and some things we didn't. What I know for sure is this, that you have to make the best out of what you're dealt.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter what that hand looks like. Once it gets in your hand, it's yours. You own it. And sometimes, You can renege. Sometimes you can, you know, and you, that means you screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
You missed something, right? And then sometimes you can make a book out of something that you never thought that you could make it of. You say to yourself, who would count that, right? And then most importantly, and anyone who understands the game of spades or being dealt a hand, you can't go back in the deck. That's cheating. And cheaters get dealt with firmly, mm-hmm. right? So you can't cheat life. You can't cheat whatever situation or circumstance is going to come that you have to deal with. You have to own it. You have to take responsibility. And the way I look at my life is just like that.
Mm-hmm.
I was dealt a hand, you know, came up a certain way. And ultimately, there were decisions that I had to make. Obviously, I could have made some better decisions. When I got in a bad situation, I didn't cheat. I mm-hmm. dealt with life on life's terms the best way that I can and affected a lot of people in a really positive way. When I could have just jumped off the edge and continued to. And there are people like that that mm-hmm. I've met in prison. They got a life sentence. Now went in with one and now they got two life sentences. Still not dealing with the mm-hmm. deck properly. Still yep. not dealing with your hand properly. And I didn't want to be that person. So in some ways I could agree with Ace's analogy with, you know, how things develop and what we do with what we have and how do we try to make that better from where we are.
Okay. Now, I know you talked a little earlier about the documentary that was made, Raising mm-hmm. the System, right?
Yeah.
So how did that even come about?
Oh, man. So that was really interesting. So I was in prison doing all of this work because it was the right thing to do. And I just mm-hmm. realized that I could, you know, I could help people out and I could, you know, I could be an asset. And while that was happening for about 19 years of that, Raising the System wasn't even on our radar. Michael was working for a TV company called Viceland.
Okay.
If you're familiar with Black Market, he did that show. And as he was closing out on that show, he sitting down with some of his producers one day and he said, listen, you know, I'm going to see my nephew this weekend. And they said, well, how old is he? And he said, how old I was. And they said, well, how long has he been in prison? You know, he's been in prison since he's been a teenager. And then they said, well, have you ever been in prison? He said, no, but I've been visiting prison since I was a teenager. And he said, oh, I said, okay. Well, how many other family? Well, I have this family member. I have this friend. And how old were they? And, you know, how old were they? And he said, and one of the producers said, that sounds like the school to prison pipeline. Mm-hmm. And Michael's like, huh? What? Like, how do you put those words in one sentence? The school to prison pipeline. And he went back to where he lived at and he was thinking about it and he was thinking about it. And he went back to some of the producers at Viceland and said, listen, I think we need to follow up and we need to do a story about that. And he went all over the country and they started doing research and started working on it. And ultimately, I became the subject of that documentary in part. And unbeknownst to us, there were some cards being dealt. And I was fortunate enough to be part of not only the documentary, but to have that be part of me being released, them capturing that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how Raised in the System was birthed.
Okay. And so that's kind of what led to Governor Cuomo recognizing you. So how did that part work?
Yeah. So no, that, you know, I was doing a lot of work in prison. I was meeting a lot of different people, grassroots organizations, coming into prison, doing the work. And there was a reentry agency that I was connected with called Exodus Transitional Community, which provides services to people, men and women who are leaving prison, and everything from housing to unemployment to job readiness to all the things that would satisfy the conditions for parole. And they were connected to some people. And one of them came in one day and said, listen, have you thought about putting in for pardon or commutation? I was like, well, what is that? And they said, go back and look it up. And I just was like, look, I come from the Pataki administration where, you know, having a life sentence was a life sentence, mm-hmm. essentially. I know people that have been to the parole board. I mean, a lot of times, 10, 15 times, they unfortunately are still in prison. And so, you know, we had Governor Cuomo, he's in, and there was a move to identify people who were doing amazing work in prison. And my warden recognized it and submitted my name to Central Office, which is the commissioner, his office, who runs state facilities in New York State. And they started the process of reviewing the work that I was doing in prison. And the commissioner made a recommendation after speaking with my warden and me getting community support from some city and state officials. And I was one of two people who had their sentence reduced. There are thousands and thousands of applicants to have their sentences reduced. And, you know, specifically for a violent crime, mm-hmm. like murder, it's almost unheard of. And since that time, I've had an opportunity to meet with Governor Cuomo, former governors in other states, mm-hmm. people in law enforcement, people essentially all over the United States. I've been to more prison since I've been out of prison than when I was in prison. All over the country. And I've connected with policymakers to have a conversation about creating conditions where we would treat people like human beings, mm-hmm. even if they committed a crime. So I partner with a lot of people, prosecutors, a lot of people across the state to help elevate that conversation. So that's how I got the attention of some people. It turns out I had their attention before I knew they had, mm-hmm. before I knew they that I had their attention. But it boils down to doing the work, right? Like, you know, you're doing the right thing and, you know, things will prosper.
Yeah. I mean, it's true.
Think about it.
It's true. I mean, no matter, I guess, what the situation is, if you stay true to yourself and you do the hard work, there's going to be a light somewhere, right? You don't Absolutely. Know what it's going to look, what color, what shade, but it's going to be some sort of light.
Absolutely.
So how did you feel when, you know, you received word that you were going to get out?
Yeah, so that was intense, right? So I was doing a lot of work in the prison's volunteer work, and I knew that my name was in the space of people that were being reviewed because there were a lot of interviews, a lot of documents, a lot of things that I had to sign off on to give other people didn't have me in custody, other government agencies, an opportunity to review, you know, the things that I had been doing while I was in prison. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget, it was December 27th where, you know, there was, I got a phone call from the housing unit. I had just returned back to the housing unit and came from work. And I was called to see, they told me to go to the superintendent's office, which essentially is unheard of. People don't go see the warden. It wasn't that unusual for me because I was one of two individuals in the second biggest facility in New York State that had outside clearance as a maximum security inmate. Mm-hmm. And that happened because, you know, me doing the work, I used to help family members bring their packages in and a host of other jobs working in the administrative building. But anyway, I got up there and they sat me in the superintendent's office, which is another thing that's unheard of. Mm-hmm. And they sat me there for a while. And as I was going to that area, a bunch of people were like giving me these looks like they knew something that I knew, and I had a good feeling, but I wasn't sure. You're never sure. And the acting superintendent walked in, and she said, "Mr. DuPont, I'm happy to inform you that the governor of the state of New York, Andrew Cuomo, has just decided to give you a commutation, and you will be released." Now, at the time, I had 5 years left on the front of my sentence, mm-hmm. 5.5 years left on the front of my sentence, and life on the back of my sentence. So it went from 5 more years to you're going home in 2.5 weeks. To put things in context for you, Rita, I would still be in prison right now. You would not know who I am. You would not be talking to me right now. I would still be in prison. My earliest possible release date was 2022. I've been home a little bit over 2 years, and I'll be off parole in 4 months. So it just goes to show you, like, you be true to yourself, mm-hmm. you do the right thing. Even if it didn't start off like that, good things happen.
It's kind of like you feel like a second chance has been given, right? And there's like a rebirth almost, because now you're starting your life all over again.
You know, I could not have put it better. And I come from spaces where, you know, people that I've been around, they not fighting for a second chance. They fighting for a first. Mm-hmm. And that's just the reality of the situation. Come up in underserved communities. They lack all the things that people need to be successful. And that's not an excuse to screw your life up. Mm-hmm. But I cannot acknowledge, it would be downright irresponsible for me to not acknowledge that, you know, people are dealing with some tough situations and circumstances, and they got to be able to work with what they got. Mm-hmm. So
since you've been out, how have you been working in the community, right? Like, what have you been doing since with respect to raising awareness? Have you also been working with any of the, you know, the prisoners that you were with before? Like, you know, I just kind of want to get a sense of, because I know that you were doing so much work in the prisons, and then, you know, you were released, right? Yep. Have you had opportunities to kind of continue that work? Yeah. And if so, like, in what capacity?
Yeah, absolutely. So I worked really hard to get out, and I worked really hard to stay out, and I worked really hard constantly do to make sure that people don't have the same fate that I had. Mm-hmm. And so there's not a person that I will not sit with. There's not a person that I will not have a conversation with when it pertains to keeping someone out of prison and providing alternatives. Mm-hmm. So just to give you an example of some of what I've been doing, primarily I do two really huge things that one is I run Michael's non-for-profit called Making Kids Win. I work with a theater company that's been around for 12 years that focuses on pressing public health and social issues called Theater of War Productions. Mm-hmm. Outside of that, we've been screening Raised in the System. We've been having meetings with members of the city council, state officials. I've met, you know, like I said, Governor Cuomo, former Governor McGreevy, doing work with him in New Jersey, all centered around reentry. A lot of work around policy. Since COVID's hit, we've been doing a lot of work around providing book bags and school supplies and making sure that we hit communities identified as oases or food deserts and providing food and trying to make sure that we have service providers present for those who are formerly incarcerated. Now, we moved into the space where, you know, we're helping people understand and making them aware about what the census is and voting mm-hmm. as a huge component of what we're doing. So in the 2.5 years that I've been out, I've been having conversations and on the front line doing all of those things, working with violence interrupters and different teams in the crisis management system, faith-based groups, all consistent with doing work that would help people in our communities heal from trauma. So those are some of the things that I've just been doing in the time that I've been out. It's been intense, busy, and thankfully, you know, I've been able to be part of the work. So
I do want to ask, with respect to the connections and the work that you're doing with elected officials, right? Because oftentimes when we talk about the work in the communities, we're really talking about the grassroots organizations and individuals who have taken it upon themselves to take back the block, to take back the communities. And a lot of times I find there to be a disconnect where the grassroots organizations or individuals feel like they don't really get enough support. They don't really get enough resources from elected officials. So that's why they got to do it themselves, right? But it seems like, you know, you've been building and been working with, you know, the governors and different elected officials, city council people. But how have you, I guess, in the time that you've spent working with them on particular projects, right, for the community, how do you really see their role? Do you find that their presence is actually felt in the communities, and maybe we just don't know what they're really doing, right? Because maybe they're working more on a policy front or more on a law-based front, and they're not necessarily seen as doing much because they're not on the ground. So like, if you could just maybe talk about that aspect, like what have you seen in terms of your interactions with these elected officials in terms of community? Because a lot of people don't really feel that, one, they actually care about the community, and two, that they're really doing anything for the people within the communities.
Yeah. You know, look, I get it, right? Like I think the first thing for me is to be able to sit down and have conversations with anyone who is committed. And for me, commitment means going the distance, no shortcuts, who's committed to dealing with whatever the challenges are in our communities. And certain people have different views. I've, you know, worked closely with Jemani. He has his opinions with NYPD and some of the things that go on. You know, I've worked with some borough commanders and, you know, other people who are willing to work in that space. I've had conversations with Eric Gonzalez as the top prosecutor in Brooklyn. You know, we've met with the attorney generals in Jersey and other places. And I do think that most people are committed, especially this day and age when community policing is at the forefront mm-hmm. of what's happening in some of our communities because of situations like Breonna Taylor and, you know, Freddie Gray and Eric Gardner and others, you know, I get it, George Floyd. So those politicians and what we've been able to do is use people of influence, Michael's platform. You know, I work closely with Mano. I've had an opportunity to meet Jay-Z, Meek Mill, all people who were committed, Robert Kraft, all of them who were having conversations about different issues, albeit a lot of those issues were interconnected, right? So, you know, Jay-Z was focusing on criminal justice and in the space of, you know, policies and probation and parole, right? But there, in that conversation, we were having, you know, other conversations that were centered around, you know, social injustice and equality and, you know, what does that look like and what does that feel like? And it's the same exact thing when I meet with other people who have different views about how do we solve these problems. So I would say that I've met some people who are really, really committed, and I've met some other people who I've left the conversation and I've said to myself, you know what? These people are not serious. They are people who are just in a space where they are all over the place and not doing the things that they need to do to help our communities here. I identify those people. We hopefully can vote them out and get people in there who are committed, you know.
Now, you talk about voting, and I know that in certain communities, that's just not something people look to do, right? Because they feel like, again, these individuals, these elected officials, these politicians have not really done anything for our community. Why am I going to waste my time voting? Whatever they bring in, just, you know, let it come in, right? Right. But I see that you're focused, like you and your team, you're focused on raising awareness about voting. And I think what you said just now is very important. You have individuals who, for whatever reason, rose to power. They're not doing anything. We, the people, have the ability to vote them out and to put somebody in that will hopefully do something, right?
Absolutely.
So how have you been able to spread that message within these communities who are a little hardened to that political process?
Yeah, you know what? I think it's about making people aware. You're not satisfied with your elected official. Your elected officials work for you. Bottom line, they are there because someone voted, enough people voted and said, listen, we think that you can handle the task and the challenges that come with these difficult responsibilities. If you're not comfortable with what's happening with them, then it's incumbent upon you to use the only process that we have to remove that person. Mm-hmm. And that process, that mechanism is voting. On this planet, yeah. That's the way to move a person. Mm-hmm. You can't move them by buying less ice cream or, you know, buying potato chips instead of, it just doesn't work like that. So if you want to make an impact, I'm a person who has had an opportunity to vote since I've been out. And I take advantage of that. I partner with people. I inform people that if you are on parole supervision in New York State, and in other states, you still have an opportunity to vote as long as you're on some form of community supervision, parole or probation. Mm-hmm. And there are some circumstances that possibly could exclude you. But it's all about being aware, and it's all about creating the conditions of having the people in office and in these positions who are willing to help shift the culture and change the narrative. And you can't do that by just putting your feet up and complaining about everything.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. And I feel like there is a lot of that going on. But I think it's also because people don't recognize the reason for voting and the importance of actually voting. The other thing that I wanted to kind of segue into is something that you and I and our team have been working on over the last, I don't know, has it been a month yet? It's been a little while. I feel like maybe not a full month, but
yeah, we're getting there.
We're getting there. We're almost there. We're almost pushing the month, but we've been working on some projects with respect to the youth, raising awareness and really addressing this gun violence epidemic, right? Mm-hmm. And I know that in our prior talks, we have discussed the fact that gun violence has been around, I mean, forever, right? This is not a new thing. People have been, you know, shooting their guns, busting their guns forever.
Absolutely.
But we're seeing that it's getting to critical points again, right? It probably may have been this critical at some point, some mm-hmm. decade, right? Mm-hmm. But right now we're seeing it reach critical points again. And so right now everybody's asking this question, what are we supposed to do? Like, how do we tackle this issue? Just over the weekend, and we've been sharing this article about the 15-year-old boy who shot up this block, and I guess nobody died, but they injured five people in the juve.
Six-year-old boy, yeah.
Right, sure. 6-year-old, I think he got shot in both legs.
Right.
Yeah.
Crown
and nostrum, right, yeah. Right. His mom got shot and some other people. So five people in total got shot. And at first, we didn't know who the culprit was. We just heard that shots were fired.
Right.
And then we come to find out it's a 15-year-old boy.
Yeah.
Right? And now, I think today, they released that he was a gangbanger or something like that.
I did see that. Yeah.
So, you know, so these are crazy issues. We're thinking about 15. Like, my son's 13. He's going to be 14. Like, these are kids that we see, you know, we probably raised them ourselves, right? So I guess my question to you is, being an individual who went in at such a young age, probably maybe close to some of the ages of some of these kids out here, mm-hmm. how do you take that experience and, in a sense, reach these children, right? Because I'm going to call them children because
right.
that's what they are.
They are. Absolutely.
How do you reach them? Like, how have you used your experience to really, you know, create like this pathway of understanding, right? Like, this is the consequences mm-hmm. Of your actions. Look
right.
at me, you
right.
know, this is what happened to me. Like, how do you do that? Because the kids of today are very interesting, as you've seen. They don't like to listen.
Yeah.
They think that they know everything and they're about their own business, right? So how do you reach out to them?
I think the first step is to a huge step for me is identifying with the issues and the challenges that young people have today.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, this has been an ancient old problem. I think a huge part of the problem And things that we need to get in front of is the fact that young kids in our communities have way too much access to illegal firearms, period. There's no Smith & Wesson there. There's no Berettas that down a block from us. These firearms are coming from another place, and law enforcement needs to find better ways to get in front of that. I think that's the first step. I think the second thing is to be able to identify with these youth and why they feel and think that the best way to handle conflict or some sort of miscommunication, beef, or disagreement is to pick up a firearm and shoot somebody. I think the root of dealing with this situation is to identify what that is about. And once we do that, I think we can get a better grip and get in front of what's going on. And I think the final component, a really important piece to this is getting with people who have influence, people that they identify as their big homies and leaders. And we need to sit at the table with them and partner with them. Gang culture is not going anywhere.
Yeah.
Bottom line, they've spent money, they spent money on that. I'm telling you, gang culture is not going anywhere. Young people having conflict is not going anywhere. The best way to get in front of this is to partner with people who we identify as leaders and get in front of this. And I know we can sit down with these men who are committed and women who are committed and offer them something else. Mm-hmm. That's another huge problem. Just gimme, 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 gimme. Not, what they need. You give me this, you give me that, and, you just figure out being hungry. You just figure out, when you sick, how healthcare is going to work out for you. When you lack education, just figure it out. No. You're going to go to these communities and you want young kids to give up guns. You want them to give up gangs, or you want them to step aside from other things that they're engaged in or involved in. You have to be willing to offer something else. And I think a huge part of the problem is that those things that are offered in affluent communities are not things that are being offered in our community. Mm-hmm. The way that law enforcement, not all law enforcement, but a lot of law enforcement, police in Brownsville and in East New York, you would never see that type of police in certain parts of Staten Island, a certain parts of Williamsburg, a certain parts of Manhattan. It just wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
It just would not happen. And I've seen communities that stick together that have a 97% voting block be policed and treated totally different. We've seen countless situations on video where they're treated different. And that goes back to the conversation that we was having earlier. But I think those are just some of the foundational things that we would need to put in play to get in front of some of these things.
Now, how do we get out of the talking phase, right? Because I find that with these issues, there's always this talking phase where we're always, we got to come together to the table. We got to have this conversation. We got to do this. And at some point, it's like, when does the conversation and an action be put in place, right? Because for the last couple of years, really, when all of this, this killing of young black unarmed men have made the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. It's been happening, obviously, from before I was born. Mm-hmm. But I think the last, 10 years, we've been seeing it play out in social media. And that's kind of raised the level of awareness within the communities. But then once that, the media kind of goes away with that that topic is done and we're back to regular scheduled program. And then somebody else gets shot, somebody else gets killed, and then we're back to it again. So I've been part of, organizations and groups. I've led talks for the last God knows how many years about the same thing. How do we, save the youth? How do we get in front of gun violence? How do we, strengthen the police and community affairs? So at what point, though, do we say, okay, we can't, we're done talking. We know what the issues are. Let's get into action.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're at that point. You know, I mean, the protests around the globe, mm-hmm. to me, indicates that we are at that point and we are taking some action steps. And, you know, I just feel like, you know, this is decades and decades and decades of situations. Mm-hmm. In the last year, maybe less, there have been protests at a level that we haven't seen, not even in the Martin Luther King days. Mm-hmm. So I think that those are the action steps that we are starting to take. I think another important action step, though, that needs to be taken in should be rooted and grounded in us making fundamental changes and culture shifting, is making sure that we have the right people in place in these positions and holding our elected officials' feet to the fire. Mm-hmm. And those are action steps. Those are just not conversations.
Yeah.
That's saying, listen, Mr. Mayor, I'm telling you, you will not be sitting here as mayor. We will require that you step down. And if whatever that takes to do that, we will do it. You're going to make these changes and you're going to make them now. Mm-hmm. And what I'm telling you is that we have a way of showing you that we can accomplish that. Mm-hmm. Now, you could either fix the problems here, do what needs to be done, or you can see what comes with not doing that. All it takes is a unified front to be able to get that done. We heard just yesterday that the whole executive team in Rochester, for a situation that happened months ago where they, you know, handcuffed a guy who was allegedly having a mental breakdown, you know, possibly using a controlled substance. They put a spit thing over his head. Mm-hmm. He died. One day, one incident. This incident happened months ago, but mm-hmm. we put a light on it, and effective immediately, you're resigning and all of your commanders are resigning. The same exact things can happen across the globe. And people will be careful when they see that those type of things happen, because they realize that you will be held accountable, and that you're not in this position to just put your feet up and to be drinking coffee and eating mm-hmm. donuts all day. You're going to do what we're going to hold your feet to the fire. You're going to do what you're supposed to be doing here while you're in office for the whole 4 years or for the whole two terms that you're mm-hmm. up here. And if not, we're going to bring smoke. Bottom line. Now, it's incumbent upon us to be effective and to be able to do that. And what that means is we just can't be marching. We can't just be talking. We can't just be doing this. We can't be doing that. We have to remind people of what their oath is. And we have to remind them that if they get away from that, that we will help them remember that they are moving away from that, and or you will be removed. And those are the things that really, really need to happen to shift the culture.
I definitely agree with you there. I think that, you know, when you mentioned earlier that there are changes being made, there are steps being taken. I totally agree with you there. I think the problem, though, when the community, you know, when they're thinking about changes and steps, they're thinking about the big picture. Like, they don't really consider marginal steps to really be steps. So if it's not fixed now, then what have you guys been doing all day? What have you guys been doing all year? So I think it is important for people to understand that change is starting to happen, that, you know, the conversations are leading to action steps.
Absolutely.
But that, like you said, it's been decades upon decades upon decades of gun violence and you know inequality and race issues within our communities, that it's not going to be fixed overnight, right? And I also agree with you with the fact that there needs to be more unity and mobilization. And I think that that's the work that you're doing, getting people to vote and getting into the communities, highlights that, right? Because, you know, we are so, I mean, if we were to put everybody in the communities together, like, we are so powerful, you know, and I think that we don't know our power because we're all like in our own little silos.
Yeah.
And so if we were to be able to mobilize, and like you said, okay, council, you know, member so-and-so, you're not doing this. Well, we're going to pick it in front of your office until you do this. I think that that would be amazing, because the white people do it all the time.
All the time.
The white people, when they are not happy, they changes are made.
It was a big issue about, I just saw it on the news today, about dining inside. So it was the gyms first. Mm-hmm. Gyms started suing.
Yep.
Got banded together. 2 days. Okay, we're going to be opening up the gyms. Limited capacity, but it'll be opening up. We'll be doing this. We'll be doing that. The restaurants, they've been open all over New York State except New York City. You could go right across the street.
In Nassau County right there.
Long Island, Nassau County, and be inside dining in Limited. Why is that not happening here? Few conversations. All of a sudden today, governor does a press conference. Whoops, we fixed that.
Yep. I actually posted that today because just last week I saw the article about 365 restaurants got together. It was the same example. Right here in Queens, one block, you can't open. Right across the street, Long Island, you can open. And I was very shocked to see indoor dining. When I saw the post today, very shocked to see that.
I wasn't. I know what can happen when people unify. Mm-hmm. I've seen that happen in prison 100 times. The philosophy in prison is divide and conquer. One thing that makes people, prison officials and officials in general, nervous is when people band together and unify and say, we will not accept this. We're not walking away. This is not going away. I'm telling you that we are going to be here. You're going to fix this. And if you don't fix it, I promise you that things are not going to turn out nice here. And sure enough, I knew it. I said, listen, there's no way that you could. I saw that same story that you talked about. There's no way that you could do this on this side of the street and on this side of the street. You couldn't. It doesn't make sense. And I knew for sure that there was only but so much that you. I knew for sure that school was going to get pushed back.
Mm-hmm.
I knew. I said, the union, there's no way.
UFT does not play.
You might think you in charge. We're going to do this. We're doing that press conference after press conference after press conference. I said, listen, I'm telling you, I don't care if it's the day before. They're going to push school back. I wake up one morning, press conference. UFT sitting right there looking at them like,
The unions do not play. That's
and
true.
And there's been a method for this. It's happened. You go back to the Rosa Parks days. I'm telling you, you're going to treat us fairly. If you don't treat us fairly, we're going to make everybody's life miserable. And the things that they felt like or said, like this couldn't change, it couldn't happen. One boycott. Whoops, it's over.
Mm-hmm.
This is it. We're changing this across the globe. And we've been known for doing this. The same thing with school. Segregating schools. We're going to change it. So the unity that it takes to be able to accomplish these things can be done in every area.
Mm-hmm.
In every area. It's been proven. It has never failed. It can happen. It's just we have to be on a unified front. We have to work really hard to be able to get these things accomplished. And we have to be relentless. You have to be relentless. You have to say that anything else for us is not an option.
Mm-hmm. And I think it goes to the point where we all have to be our brothers and sisters' keeper. Absolutely. Like, just because I got it and I'm good now and my kids now live in a good neighborhood doesn't mean you turn your back on the rest of the people. Whether you were born and raised in these neighborhoods or not, as a black person, right, seeing your fellow man in, destitute, like you, that should be a spark of like anger inside of you. Like, absolutely. I cannot see my brother and sister like this.
Absolutely.
So I would hope that with that concept of being your brother and sister's keeper, that could then lead to unity, because within the black community, there's class, there's all these different types of divisive, mechanisms that allow, I saw an article the other day about the wealthy blacks, right, and how they've dealt with COVID. Like, nobody's really talked about the high society black people, right, that are sitting here probably making millions of dollars off of these situations. Meanwhile, we have the other side, right, of COVID, the poor blacks, as they like to label us. But just to see, like, so where is that community when it comes to these talks, right? The gun violence, the race and inequality. Where are these uppity black people? Where are they?
Michael and I talk about it all the time. We're one of the only people that, say things like, I'm going to get out. I'm going to be successful and then I'm going to get out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go do this. I'm going to go do that. And, you leave your community and Michael has said, where we running to? Where we going out to? Like, where we going? And, you know, at the forefront of the service work that we're doing is being in our communities. You know, he lives in Brooklyn, works in Brooklyn, does, you know, a lot of our service work is in Brooklyn. You know, we don't want accolades. We don't want credit. We want to see our people survive and thrive and be successful. And that's what this is about. Mm-hmm. No pat on the backs. No thank you. We doing what we supposed to do. And there's so many people that don't recognize.
It's heavy topics. Yeah. It's always heavy topics. But I think the amazing part of all of this is that there are people who are doing the work. There are people who care. And although, you know, you're not doing it for the accolades, you're not doing it for the fame or whatever the case is, I think it's still important to acknowledge people who are, because you could not be doing the work, right? You could be like, listen, I'm home. Let me try to, you know, salvage the rest of my life and let me just do all of this. Like, I don't need to look back and you know, and reach back. But instead, you've decided that, you know what, you know, for as long as you live, you're going to, you know, try to, you know, save a life. You're going to try to make, you know, better ways for people in the community. And I think that's very commendable, because not many people who have, you know, gotten out of prison has done that, right? They haven't done that because they were just, I mean, and I can't even say they're being selfish, right? Because they're like, they have to focus on themselves. They feel like they have to. But again, it's that idea of community that I think a lot of us don't really, we keep saying community, community, but what is a community, right? What is that?
For me, the root word of community is unity. Mm-hmm. And that's what community is for mm-hmm. me. It is unity. It's us being together and supporting each other and saying, we can make this happen and we can be successful. So, yeah.
And I think for me, I'm thinking, you know, when I think about community, I think about, you know, being communal, you know, exactly. Breaking bread with each other, being together at the table, living amongst each other and caring about what's going on next door and not saying, well, that's not my business. Definitely. So I think once we are truly able to get to that point, we'll see changes, right?
Like, I think so.
So, thank you so much. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you so much.
I'm pretty sure people have, you know, have so many questions, obviously, and they tend to send me little DMs like, you know, what's going on here? We want to follow up. So I'm pretty sure you will be back on this show.
I would love that.
For a follow up.
Thank you.
But yeah, thank you for taking the time to just talk about your life. You know, sometimes it's not the easiest thing to go back and relive moments. And so I'm really grateful more so that you were able to do that. And hopefully your story will, you know, touch somebody, right? Whether it is somebody who's either currently in or somebody who just came out or somebody who's a family member of an individual who, you know, who's, you know, recently incarcerated. So I, you know, I really hope that you come back.
Thank you. I will. I promise. You got my word.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, everyone. Thank you for tuning into another episode of According to RP on WJMS Radio. It's your girl, Rita Pierre, your host, and we'll talk next.
You were listening to According to RP on WJMS Radio.
About time you tuned in.
Tune in each and every Sunday.
I can't wait to come back.
7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
It's on.